I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. If your town is invaded by tourists, does it inevitably mean more traffic, idling tour buses, and tacky trinket shops? Or is a better option possible, one that still attracts tourism dollars, but also serves the needs of locals? Dan Schilling and Mark McDermott have been studying the effects of a kinder and gentler tourism, something they call civic tourism. They believe it is a more sustainable approach to tourism and economic development, and they're planning the first national conference on the topic in Prescott, Arizona, March 16th through 18th. Our topic is civic tourism. Our guests are Dan Schilling and Mark McDermott. Plus, Steve Goldsmith will introduce us to Cindy Carlson, an Innovations in Government Award winner who runs Hampton, Virginia's Coalition for Youth. We'll return to Smart City after this news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Steve Goldsmith is former mayor of Indianapolis and now heads Harvard's Innovations in Government Awards.
You know, we've been looking a lot recently at civic participation. Bob Putnam, in his well-known book called Bowling Alone, Harvard professor, talks about the decline of participation in neighborhoods and families and communities. Very troubling aspect for those of us concerned about the relationship between government and its citizens. I'm chairman of the Corporation for National Community Service, and we just finished a survey which remarkably shows that for the first time there is a post-9/11 service generation. Young adults, more than any other age group after 9/11, have sustained high commitments of service. And we can really see this in one of our award winners, the Youth Civic Engagement from Hampton, Virginia, where the town reached out to youth and allowed them to participate in how they planned and how they allocated resources. And this Hampton example, consistent with what we see in this post-9/11 service increase, means very, very good things for the future of the relationship, the American democracy between government and its citizens.
Cindy Carlson runs the Hampton Coalition for Youth. The coalition was founded on a question that Hampton's leaders ask: are we doing all that we can to ensure that our youth can be productive members of our workforce and community of tomorrow? It's an interesting question. Where did it lead you?
It's led us to places we had no idea we would be at this point, because the question doesn't really imply that you would look at young people throughout the first two decades of their life to make sure that they are contributing, happy, capable, involved citizens of the community. And so when we started looking at how young people can really thrive in our community, it led us to see that we really need to be engaging them in the answers to those questions, that it's an ongoing process.
What were the barriers you uncovered that kept young people in Hampton from becoming productive citizens?
I think our barriers are the same as they are in any other community, but probably the greatest one that young people identified is that they are not seen as citizens of a community. They're either feared or neglected or kind of seen as recipients of the programs or the services that adults provide. And their point to us continuously was, why can't you see us as resources? Why can't we be a part of solving all of these problems and making this a better place?
And where did you conclude that you could get the greatest leverage for improving outcomes for young people?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, in terms of looking at how you wanted young people to be assets to your community, what investment could you make, Cindy, that you thought would have the biggest payoff?
I guess for us in Hampton, one big investment has been in the recruitment, training, and support of young people to be active parts of all of the life of the community, whether it's being involved in their neighborhoods, their schools, local government, the organizations they belong to. The investment, I guess, for us is in making sure that their voice is an important part of the operation of all of those pieces of the community, and that together, young people and adults are tackling the things that need to be tackled in the community.
Why was this done at City Hall rather than through your schools?
Well, local government is in a unique position to be the catalyst or the convener for an entire youth agenda for the city, which includes in-school time and out-of-school time. There are a lot of things that young people are engaged in their neighborhoods, in within the nonprofit world, the youth-serving organizations. Young people are really an integral part of the whole community, and local government is kind of positioned uniquely to be the catalyst for that happening.
City Hall has clearly adopted an attitude of young people as an asset rather than as a liability. Is that attitude widely held among the citizens of Hampton?
The attitude of seeing young people as a resource is one, I think, that continues to grow and grow in our community. And I think the more that young people and adults are placed together in situations where they're asked to do meaningful work, the more, I guess, believers that we might have. It can start with a very small number of people who are comfortable working with young people in this different kind of a way, and then it can expand throughout the community.
Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City. Cindy Carlson runs the Hampton Coalition for Youth. You're listening to Smart City. Dan Schilling directs the Civic Tourism Project. He calls it a sustainable approach to tourism and economic development. This federally funded project will conclude with a national conference March 16th through 18th in Prescott, Arizona, that will bring together scholars, practitioners, and researchers for new insights in this emerging field. Mark McDermott will be a speaker at that conference. He's former director of tourism for the state of Arizona. Dan, what is civic tourism?
Well, civic tourism is really an extension of several other commonly called alternative approaches to tourism, like ecotourism, heritage tourism, cultural tourism, that have been around for about 10, 20 years. And what civic tourism tries to do is bring together the best of those projects and those approaches, and also add sort of a dab of civic engagement to the process, because one of the things we realize is that as tourism becomes more and more an approach that focuses on a community's place, that is, its history, its culture, etc., we want to engage the public in a conversation about appropriate tourism development.
And tell me about the kinds of tourism development, Mark, that are not appropriate. I know that you've said tourism can be used in a very positive way if it's managed properly. So what are the typical mistakes communities make in their pursuit of tourism dollars?
I think the typical long-standing mistake is their pursuit is just an all-out marketing assault without a fair leverage of thought being given to what is the product and how should the product be presented and what, in fact, is the sense of place of this destination that really makes it unique and different, and how do we build upon that? How do we enhance this sense of place, this place that makes us special, to, in fact, ultimately create a place that people are interested in visiting, but even more so a place that is a healthy community for the residents of that community. See, tourism is first and foremost an economic development initiative in all communities. Its primary purpose is to generate ancillary revenues into a community, generating subsequent tax revenues to provide for government services that are needed so that the taxes on the residents can be obviously kept from having to be raised to provide for those services. And all too often, I think the mistakes are made that the marketing is targeted just too much in the way of mass marketing instead of towards a higher quality or higher value customer that is interested in the kind of amenities that a healthy community has to offer in the first place, from the heritage perspective, from the ecotourism perspective, from the cultural perspective as well. And so I think the mistake that they make is they just sort of look to generate as much traffic from wherever as they possibly can. And that kind of leads to tourism development that might be less desirable and cause tourism to have a reputation in the minds and eyes of the residents of a community as not being good because of the resultant types of development that might come with that in terms of less than desirable retail storefront type of development and less than desirable infrastructure impact issues such as traffic and so forth.
Mark, give me an example of a community that you think
has done it wrong.
Yes, done it wrong. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Oh, good grief. I hate to say that any community has actually done it wrong. I think there's some good examples of communities that could do it better, that might maybe wish they had done things a little bit differently. Here in Arizona, I think it might be safe to say that there's a lot of discussion and concern around the community of Sedona. One of our most beautiful ecotourism areas is the Sedona area. But the way that tourism has developed in Sedona has really resulted in more or less a visitor industry service sprawl, so to speak, that is often referred to as a kind of pollution, as a sign pollution and a directional pollution that makes it very difficult to really enjoy the essence and the sense of place of that community because of all that's been done with regard to commercial tourism development in and throughout the community. So that's one example, although that is not to say that Sedona still is not just one of the most wonderful places on the face of the earth to visit, because it is, but there are things that they might have done differently or could have done differently that might have made it very, very special instead of a place that invites some questioning with regard to why does it have to be like this at this stage.
What are those things they could have done differently?
Well, I think they could have planned the whole process better. They could have had oversight into signage regulations, into architectural design regulations, town center planning and development, heritage implications, better approach to telling the story of the history and the heritage of Sedona and its original peoples and its growth and development and so forth and so on. To me, it sort of smacks of, if you will, sort of kind of willy-nilly development.
And just to follow up on what Mark was saying, the folks in Sedona who are in charge of community planning, town planning, tourism planning, recognize this. We're not saying anything, you know, that they don't know. And in fact, there is a move on there, as there are in a lot of towns. I think what's happened in many tourism towns, and Sedona is certainly a tourism town, is that they've created the town around taking care of tourists or attracting tourists, as opposed to really taking care of the residents. And what you often end up with is, you know, the large streets with just a lot of malls, and there's not a real focus on creating a downtown, so to speak, a real sense of place. And Sedona does have a project going on now to try to create that there. You know, the old line, there's no there there. Well, that's pretty true of Sedona and a lot of towns, where they just feel like a large parking lot, if you will, with big streets going through and the car is privileged over people, etc. So there's a move there to focus more, I think, on creating a more walkable, pedestrian-friendly place that's attractive to tourists, but also that really serves the residents who live there.
Dan, one of the ways in which you distinguished civic tourism, as you said, it has a smidgen of civic engagement. Tell me what you mean by that.
To be honest, that's the sort of the background that I come out of. I was into civic development and community development and civic engagement before I got into tourism. And, you know, when I stumbled into the tourism sector about 15 years ago, I was primarily working in cultural and heritage tourism. And the one thing I noticed was that the conversation was very much among that industry. It was the chambers of commerce and the tourism bureaus and occasionally a museum or a U.S. Forest Service. But where was the public in this conversation? And the fact is that tourism is becoming more and more focused on sense of place. The idea that, you know, just want to bring in a theme park, that's sort of passé now. Most people recognize that's not the way to do tourism development. So if you are, in effect, marketing a place that is people's historic districts and their forests and their streets and their cultures, that's a conversation that the community should be engaged in. And the problem is, when you talk about tourism in many towns, people are generally in one or two boxes. Either they're in the sort of the Chamber of Commerce box, where they only see tourism as a good thing, economic development and jobs and bed taxes, or they're in the anti-tourism box. And we need to be honest and recognize that a lot of people don't like what tourism has done to their community, and so they often just speak negatively about tourism. Well, if we just stay stuck in these boxes, the pro-tourism box or the anti-tourism box and debate one another, we're never going to be able to talk about how we can use tourism as a positive force in our communities. Instead of, you know, debate, we should be deliberating. And that's really where civic engagement comes in, is helping the communities to have positive, constructive conversations about how they use tourism. Because here's the truth. It's not going away. I mean, this is the largest industry in the world. It's the largest industry here in Arizona, and it's either the first, second, or third largest industry in every state in America. So it has tremendous potential to change the way communities look and feel and operate. So it's a reality that we have to deal with. So the idea that we can just put up walls to keep tourists out, which is what some of the anti-tourism voices say, it's just not a reality. We're not going to go there. So let's figure out how we can develop tourism as a force that helps communities preserve and enhance the things that they love about their towns. And there's evidence that can happen. I mean, I work in a museum that would not exist without tourist dollars. So here's a positive, tangible example of how tourism helps the people in Prescott, Arizona, preserve and enhance and celebrate the history and the culture of Prescott. So let's apply that kind of sort of progressive, proactive thinking to other areas of our community and not see tourism as the problem, which is the way a lot of people talk about it, but as a solution to placemaking.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Dan Schilling, he's director of the Civic Tourism Project, and Mark McDermott, who is a speaker at the upcoming Civic Tourism Conference, March 16th through 18th in Prescott, Arizona. Dan, how do you get that productive conversation you're referring to? How do you get that started?
Well, that's the challenge in any kind of a civic engagement, isn't it? Whether you're talking about immigration or water or, you know, or tourism.
Yes, it is.
People say they don't have the time, et cetera, et cetera. Part of the solution, of course, is, as I was saying, let's go beyond the usual suspects. We just don't want the Chamber of Commerce and the usual voices in the room. The problem, I think, with a lot of civic engagement programs is the way that it's framed. And here, in this project, this is not just a tourism project, per se. People need to understand. I mean, they often think of tourism, well, it's just hotels and restaurants, et cetera, and gift shops. Tourism is so ingrained into every aspect of every community that it's not a single slice of the economic pie, so to speak. It really is the community's economic future in many cases. So we need to talk about this not as a tourism project, so to speak, but as an approach that looks at the future of their communities environmentally, socially, economically, et cetera. Clearly, you need to make people feel welcome at these, that their voice is welcome. And we have techniques and we have some strategies and we have some mechanisms for, as I was saying, getting people out of their boxes, actually forcing them to look at tourism not as just, well, for instance, you know, when we do these meetings around the state that I've been doing with Mark, one of the things is we say, look, the first person that talks about tourism as economic an engine or the first person that talks about tourism as the things that ruins my town, take that conversation elsewhere. We're here to have a constructive conversation. And so we do focus on, we have some deliberative techniques and whatnot that we use to have that conversation. But I think your point is well taken that people are busy. They say they don't have time for community events. We all know about the bowling alone syndrome with people not voting even and not coming to public meetings. But I really think that tourism could be the leverage to bring people out to these meetings, because the fact is that the kind of tourism we're talking about impinges on the things that people really love and care about in their communities, you know, their historic districts, their forests, their trails, their cultures, their histories, etc.
Tell me what you've seen, both of you, as the best examples of cities that have pursued civic tourism.
This is Dan. I'll chime in with a few cities that I primarily travel around the West, and I go up and down the Rockies quite a bit. That's the thing about this project, is that as I've traveled around the West, you get a sense of what places are. They're already doing civic tourism. They might not call it that. But they recognize that their sense of place is so important to their future, and they don't want to screw it up. And I think of towns like Missoula. In Montana, I could name a few, Missoula and Bozeman and even Helena, I think, do a very good job of preserving their sense of place for touristic purposes. They don't really feel like tourism towns, yet they have a strong tourism economy. And certainly down the West, larger towns like San Francisco, was what makes it so unique, is that it is different. And that's certainly central to civic tourism, is that it's not a copycat approach. It's, you know, you take what's in your community and you help to reveal the special qualities of your place. We know that that's what tourists want to visit more and more, is that that's why here in Arizona, for instance, that's why they love to go to places like Bisbee, which is just an amazing little gem of a community, because it's so different, it's so unique, and it's a tourism town, there's no doubt about that. But you don't feel as if when you're walking around town that, you know, everybody is from someplace else. It still feels like a real town. And I would throw in there the place where I work. I think Prescott, Arizona is a lovely community that it may not call it civic tourism, but it's doing something like that.
Mark, what about you? Do you have your favorites?
There are various towns, I guess, throughout. I've worked in New York State, and I've worked in Florida, and I've worked here in Arizona, and there are a number of towns that do it right, and I think this is a mechanism that really applies more to rural communities than it does to larger urban areas that are already very well built and developed, and there's not much opportunity to affect change in those communities. And you could name a number of them. But I think, to me, a little bit different perspective on it is what this concept brings in the way of an opportunity for a community, especially a rural community or a smaller emerging community, to plan smartly, I think. Tourism, well, what I like best about this whole concept is, and I'm a career tourism guy, I'd go into towns and look for as much money as I could possibly get just to market the heck out of these towns and get as many people coming in there. And as time went on, we got smarter about our marketing and more targeted and more aimed at higher value visitors in these places. But we still failed on the tourism front to, I think, focus on the product, and the product being the community and its sense of place, and what needed to be done to preserve that and enhance that. If you look in most towns, whether they're doing it right or they're not doing it right, you really can sort of say each town has the following three sectors and then some. But the three sectors that we kind of find ourselves dealing with is the chamber of commerce or the business community that exists in that town. And they're interested, as they're organized under the chamber, in business promotion or business vitality and essentially getting more customers into their shops, right? And then you have the town government, so to speak, which may have an interest in economic development. In most cases, they do. But in many cases, tourism is a very low priority in their economic development scheme of things, because it's largely viewed as a lesser desirable, service-oriented, low-wage industry, not the kind of high-tech or high-value visit industry that you want to go after and try to recruit to your town. So they don't focus so heavily on tourism. They kind of, if you will, disrespect it, I think, to some degree, rather than using it smartly. And then you have the residents. And residents, unless they're the business owners that have those shops that need the additional visitors, they tend to be what? Anti-tourism, basically. They don't want more visitors crowding their streets. They don't want tourism-type t-shirt shops and trinket shops in their town. And they just want businesses that will serve their needs in the town. And they fail to recognize that there's a happy medium between the two, where you can have businesses that serve their needs but also are of a scale that they attract the interest of outsiders. So I think that the challenge of this whole civic tourism thing is, as Dan says, is to get these sectors out of their individual boxes and get them talking together about how to most effectively use tourism as an enabler or a foundation, if you will, for smart development and ultimately for healthy community development and a higher level of quality of life for the residents. That's what I see. I think that all economic development in most of these communities almost has to begin with tourism, because you have to have the kind of place that people want to go to in order to attract any kind of business, you know, in this day and age. Communities seeking corporate relocations or corporate branch locations or whatever it may be really have to have within themselves a quality of life and a sense of place that the corporations themselves find appealing and feel that their employees or their ability to recruit employees will be positively impacted by, in the sense that, you know, you want to have a place that people want to live in, right? And so I think that you need to look at it from the standpoint of, if you want to develop business economically as a community, and most communities do, that you have to have building blocks. And I see embracing and using tourism as sort of the primary building block, the foundation. And if you take it from this perspective, of civic tourism, where you're focusing on the culture and the heritage and the sense of place and the eco-environment of a community, and preserving and better yet enhancing that, that creates the draw, that creates, that makes it a destination, a place people are interested in going and seeing. And the economic influx of the spending by those visitors as they come in to see generates the revenues that are needed by the businesses, the tax revenues that are needed by the town, and the opportunities for jobs that are needed by the residents and their families and so forth within. And it sort of creates a circle that works all the way around. So, and you can build upon this base of economic, this service sector sort of base economic development to do then your higher end or higher value economic development of trying to attract a branch of Google, whatever it may be.
After a short break, we'll continue our conversation about civic tourism with Dan Schilling and Mark McDermott. But first, we'll talk to Otis White about news from cities. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, most communities, when they are confronted with the decision of whether to build a capital project, whether it be a symphony hall or a new stadium, they usually do some economic impact study that seems to always show that, in fact, it's a good thing to build that capital project, and there are going to be lots of spinoff benefits from doing so. What have you found out about that?
Well, they're trying to build just such a project here in Atlanta. It's a $300 million symphony hall, and it's an extravagant-looking building. And they've raised a fair amount of money for it. They're now trying to persuade the state of Georgia and the city of Atlanta to chip in some money themselves. They want $50 million each. And their argument is that it's good for the economy to do this. That is, they're arguing for the Atlanta Symphony that this will be another reason for tourists to spend an extra night in Atlanta to catch the Brahms concert, or convention goers and tourists will come here for another reason and will just stay and hear Emmanuel Acts down at the new Symphony Hall. And oddly enough, the state seems to be buying this argument. That is, the legislature, the governor, seem to be seriously considering this. It probably helps a little bit that they've got a surplus this year. But, you know, I may be the only one, but I'm a little skeptical of the notion that large numbers of tourists are going to travel to a city just to hear classical music, or that, you know, you come for the Kitchen Fixtures Convention and you stay on to hear Emmanuel Acts perform. I like Emmanuel Acts. I'm just doubtful that there are a lot of folks who sort of on an impulse stay for classical music. Now, I think it is true that there are a lot of folks who drive into cities to see it, that is, they live maybe in a smaller community and drive to hear the symphony, but I just don't know that there are all these folks who will come hear one symphony over another simply because it's in a new city and with a new concert hall. There is a good argument for building such things, however, and it actually does have an economic component to it. The first reason for doing it is classical music, say what you want, it tends to make people smarter. It is refining, it makes us more cultivated people, more cultured people, and for that reason alone, we ought to support a symphony in our community. The second thing is that it does send a signal to people that this is a community of some sophistication. And that does have an economic impact because it tends to draw in folks who may never go to the symphony themselves, but they like knowing this is a community that has one and that supports with a nice concert hall. I'm reminded back in the 1980s, I was talking with an executive who had moved from Chicago to a smaller city, and I asked him what it was he missed about Chicago. Among the many things he liked about the new community, he said, well, I miss the Cubs, I miss Michigan Avenue, I miss the Chicago hot dogs, and I miss the opera. And I looked at him and I said, well, are you an opera buff? Did you attend the opera a lot? He said, no, I never went. He said, I just like knowing it was there. And a lot of people feel that way about communities they move to. They just like knowing they have the symphony. So it has an economic component, but the notion that concert halls are going to greatly boost tourism is probably not a sound one.
We keep making these phony arguments for amenities when, in fact, I think your argument is by far the better one, and that's confirmed by senior economist Jonathan Rappaport. We talked with him, who said the calculated economic benefits rarely materialize.
Yes.
In fact, communities should simply make a gut judgment about the value of amenities. And when they feel it's the right thing to do, they should simply do it. And I was very surprised hearing that coming from an economist.
Yeah,
but nonetheless, he makes the same argument you make.
There you are.
We'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. We're talking with Dan Schilling and Mark McDermott about civic tourism. Mark is director of the Arizona Office of Tourism. You must have seen many projects that were justified on the basis of it will attract more tourists. How did you weigh the cost and benefits of a project that was proposed on that rationale?
Well, you're right. We saw many, many projects, or we received many, many proposals, we always do, usually event-oriented, more so than new product development-oriented types of things that will attract more visitors. I suppose the biggest one we ever dealt with was the stadium issue, you know, and what the impact on tourism that the stadium means, the economic impact in terms of visitation related to teams coming in to play football games here and other events that the stadium as a multi-purpose facility could host and so forth. So that's probably the ultimate, and of course the economic impact is in the multi-millions, hundreds of millions, thousands of millions of dollars down the line, and that's why the tourism industry got behind it and supported it. But then, yes, we also saw an array of all kinds of other festivals, events, theme park proposals, and things like that. And I think you just sort of weigh each one individually, and you look at it and you say, is this realistic? Does it really have the value? Is there sound research behind what the proponents are saying as to the down-the-line impact of it and so forth, and evaluate it accordingly. One of the things in Arizona during my 7 years there we always encouraged those kinds of proposals because that kind of thinking and those kinds of ideas, because we felt that Arizona's tourism product was really kind of static. It wasn't going anywhere. It sat in five primary niches as we looked at it, but it wasn't evolving. It wasn't growing and developing. And of course, there was a lot of talk about could we put a theme park in here or there or wherever. And could we or could we not try to develop product that is more germane to our culture, our history, and our heritage as a state, and how would that be done, and where would the funds come by, and so forth and so on. But there was never a good organized aspect of thinking along those lines. It was always more related to proposals that would come to us and some ancillary dialogue that took place related to that. So I guess in answer to your question, I would say simply we had to evaluate each one on its individual merits. And more often than not, things would involve various meetings of various parties who thought this was a good idea. But I'm afraid I have to say that more often than not in Arizona, not much ever really happened, except, of course, for commercial development. I mentioned the five product niches that we sort of focused on in Arizona. Those were basically your number one being nature and adventure. The main reason people come here is obviously the fantastic scenery in the state combined with the weather and the adventure opportunities that relate to that. Number two being the culture, the Southwest Native American and cowboy culture, if you will. Number three being what we called golf and sports. Number four being what we called resorts to ranches, meaning they have the single largest concentration of 4- and 5-star resorts of any state in the country, as well as unique types of accommodations, facilities in the form of ranches, and I think the whole spa syndrome really germinated out of here. And then finally, we created a niche that we called shopping and entertainment, which was sort of all-encompassing of all the rest because of all the research that was out there of how much people spend shopping when they travel, and even some sectors that supposedly travel just to shop. But within those niches, if you look at them, just to close the thought, is if you look at product development opportunities within those niches, there are three of those niches that are commercially and private sector oriented, and two of those niches that are not commercial or private sector oriented, and those are the ones that we think need some attention. The commercial niches of resorts to ranches and golf and shopping entertainment, they take care of themselves. The corporate world reinvests in their own product, and we've seen what's happened here in terms of ever-increasing number of resorts and so forth. at golf courses, etc. But if you take a look at the nature and adventure niche, that's outdoor nature. That's our ecotourism. That's our heritage and our related outdoor adventure opportunity niche. And then there's our culture and heritage niche. Those niches are the niches that need attention to the product and some kind of guiding assistance to how they can be preserved, enhanced, and developed. And so I think that the essence of this whole civic tourism thing is let's focus on those niches that represent the sense of place, A, of our individual communities, but also, really, of our entire state of Arizona, and see what we can do about helping communities focus on these niches and enhancing those products for the purpose of drawing the interest of potential visitors.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Mark McDermott. He is the former director of the Arizona Office of Tourism and a speaker at the upcoming Civic Tourism Conference in Prescott, Arizona. And Dan Schilling is the director of the Civic Tourism Project. Dan, I think Mark mentioned the size, the enormous size of the tourism business. When you look at the civic tourism niche, how large a role does that play in the overall tourism economy?
Well, that's a great question, because one of the things we make clear when we go to communities is to say that this is not the only way to do tourism in your community. Some of you are doing great jobs. We understand that. And this is really, civic tourism is really another tool that a community can use, I think, as Mark was saying, to help them identify what their product is, first of all. I mean, that's really where this program begins, is helping primarily rural and mid-sized towns figure out what the product is that they're going to market. And if you're looking at essentially small and mid-sized communities, this is a huge part of their tourism attraction. You know, most of the towns in Arizona, many of the towns in Arizona, have lost their original economic engine. You know, they're not mining much anymore. They're not lumbering. They're not ranching anymore. And they look around and they say, wow, tourism's a clean industry. It's great economic impact. Why don't we get in that business? And so the first thing they have to figure out is, what product do they have that's actually going to attract people to their community? And most of them tend to look at their culture and their history and their environment, because that's what they have that distinguishes them from Phoenix or Tucson or Las Vegas or some other place. So the question is, how do they, again, identify what that product is? One of the things we say is, how do these different niches work together? I mean, I've been in the sort of alternative tourism business a long time, and one thing I recognize is that the ecotourists and the cultural tourists and the preservation tourists and all those people who we say that, you know, focus on sense of place, they rarely work together. So we're trying to get them in the same boat. But then you get around to the question of funding. And as Mark was saying, we need to do basically research and development. That's what civic tourism is. It's R&D for place-based development. These communities know that they have something special. They need to figure out, you know, how to identify it, what will attract tourists. But then we get around to the question of funding. And I've worked for foundations and whatnot for a long time that fund museums and cultural programs and eco programs. And I know how little money there is going into the preservation and the enhancement of the product. So if the tourism industry is going to focus more and more on sense of place as the product, I think it's their responsibility in many ways, or at least the government's responsibility, to invest in that product.
Dan, you're planning the Civic Tourism Conference March 16th, 17th, and 18th in Prescott, Arizona. Tell me about the agenda and what you hope to accomplish at that meeting.
We know this is sort of groundbreaking, if I can be so presumptuous to use that word. I know Mark and I attend a lot of tourism conferences, a lot of cultural conferences over the years, smart developing conferences, the sort of the, you know, livability programs, the Richard Florida stuff. And in fact, I'll just put in a little note there that I think the work of Florida, Richard Florida, is central to this, because what he's talking about is, how do you create communities that are going to attract the right workers, the right corporations and everything. And we're saying the same thing, only our focus is, how do you create communities that attract what we call high-value visitors. And when you look at Florida's research and our research, it sort of parallels one another. So the conference is not just tourism people, and there's some great tourism researchers and scholars there, people like Hal Rothman here in the West, who writes a lot about tourism, people from the industry who work at Civic Convention and Visitors Bureaus, et cetera, who understand that their tourism perhaps needs to be thought of or evolve in a different way, but also people who focus on sense of place. We have really four tracks where we say, One of our tracks is people who study and research this whole notion of place. And anybody who's worked in that industry of trying to tell a community story, trying to preserve sense of place, knows that it's not an easy thing to do. I think that's one of my criticisms of the tourism industry is they just say, okay, package place and sell it, and you know the right people will come. It's a hard thing to do. So we have people like Tim Beatley from Virginia who writes great books about sense of place, and folks here like Gary Nabhan, one of the MacArthur Prize winners, the so-called Genius Award, who really focuses on culture and history. But then we have people who are coming who are doing some really interesting things within this whole concept of place-based tourism, like Neil Shoemaker out of Harlem, who runs the Harlem Heritage Tours, etc. And then we have some folks who are doing what I would consider really cutting-edge work. Dave Weaver down in South Carolina has a program called the Ecotourium, and they're really sort of pushing the boundaries of how do we get the tourism industry and the place-based communities to work together. And then this other sort of aspect of civic engagement, how do you bring what we know about civic engagement to the tourism conversation. And there we have people like Dan Kemis, who's a former mayor and legislator in Montana, who's written some great books about civic engagement and citizenship and communitarianism, and he runs a think tank now up in Missoula. So people like Dan Kemis will be coming to help us figure out how do we apply what we know works with civic engagement, how do we apply that to the tourism conversation, because I think that's really sort of the missing link that we're trying to fill here. There hasn't been a lot of attention to the how of the process. Many people are saying, and there are other, you know, we're not the only tourism group out there saying involve the public. Certainly the people who do geotourism and community tourism and some of the other approaches are saying that. But I think even they would recognize that there hasn't been much attention paid to the actual process. I mean, how do you bring people into the conversation? And once they're there, how do you really frame the conversation so it's going to be constructive?
It seems like one of the tensions that you're trying to deal with in civic tourism is how a community can keep a healthy sense of the past, where it's come from, but keep moving into the future. In other words, not totally abandoning the past, but not letting the past hold you back, but using it as a strong base to move into the future and not forgetting where you came from. Does that underlie at least some of the civic tourism discussion?
This is Dan. Yes, I don't want to give the impression when we talk to communities that, you know, you've got this great history here, this famous thing happened in 1878, and so you need to say stuck in 1878. And you certainly see that when you work on the reservations and when you work in some of the smaller historic towns, is people have this idea that you're going to go to the reservation and you're still going to see, you know, Native Americans looking like they did in 1860 or whatever. All cities evolve. All cultures evolve. And we have to recognize that, you know, Tombstone, Arizona, is not the Tombstone that it was when Wyatt Earp and those guys had to shoot him up at the OK Corral. It's a changing community. And what I think we're saying, however, is that you need to evolve within the sort of the parameters of your community's culture and its story and its history and what makes it unique. Don't try to import what happened in Baltimore just because it worked there, but focus on your place's history, its culture, its and including its natural environment, etc., and just keep the best interests of your place in front of you as you move ahead. One of the things we say is don't focus on quantity, focus on quality. I mean, there's a big difference between designing a tourism program to bring more people and designing a tourism program to enhance what's already there. And that's really the distinction we make. So we recognize the towns are going to change. There's no doubt about that. But change within the context of your town's story.
You can find more information about the Civic Tourism Conference on our website, smartcityradio.com. Mark, Dan, thanks so much for being our guest, and good luck with the conference. It really sounds like it will be a very interesting conversation.
Thank you. We appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Dan Schilling directs the Civic Tourism Project. Mark McDermott will be a speaker at the conference Dan is organizing on civic tourism, March 16th through 18th. Registration information is available at smartcityradio.com. CityView's commentator Walker Smith says the intrusion of humans on the wilderness habitat should be the focus of our concern rather than the other way around.
There are two phones in the Grand Canyon, both at Phantom Ranch, one near the boat beach and one near the general store. Whenever I've tried to use either one of them, I've always had to wait in line. This never ceases to amaze me. a mile below the rim in the middle of an immense, challenging wilderness, and there I am, standing in line just like it was Times Square. The very thing I go there to escape still catches up with me. The reach of civilization that far into the depths of the vast Colorado Plateau is confounding, but perhaps not so surprising. After all, every venture into that wilderness is saturated with modern technology. The rafts that run the rapids were first developed by the Army during World War II. Backcountry trekkers depend on the strong featherweight boots, packs, tents, and ropes developed from modern alloys and composites. Energy bars and hydration bladder packs are big business. Phantom Ranch has power, sells beer and sunscreen, and delivers mail. True, early explorers and Native Americans before them got by without this equipment, but not without the modern technologies of their times. Their artifacts are found in every corner of the Grand Canyon, from the very first appearance of humankind to today's adventure tourism. Civilization has always accompanied people into that wilderness. It's the only way we can get there. Indeed, a wilderness experience is just a matter of degree. Absent what civilization provides, wilderness is inaccessible to us. But too much civilization, and something vital is lost. Yet the threshold beyond which the experience becomes too tame often can be hard to define. Are contour maps too much? Trails, stoves, satellite phones, headlamps and extra batteries, retractable walking sticks, ATVs, a parking lot and a porta potty at the trailhead? The Augusta Canal that parallels the Savannah River through Augusta, Georgia, was completed in 1850 and passes today under I-20. But on the water in a kayak, you are surrounded by flowering wild plants of every color, as well as river otters, herons, alligators, and a surfeit of sunning turtles. It's within earshot of Riverwatch Parkway, but it's no less of a refuge because of that. The mere presence of civilization is not a threat to wilderness. Where we go astray is when wilderness is lost to civilization. What we need is more than wilderness shielded from civilization. We need an infusion of the wild into our citified lives. Indeed, our civilized existence depends upon the things that wilderness provides. Natural resources, medical discoveries, places for sport, balance, retreat, and perspective, and an experience of the sublime. So when waiting in line in the Grand Canyon, I remind myself that the biggest threat is not the phones at Phantom, but the banishment of the wild from our civilized lives. The most compelling reason to preserve the integrity and sanctity of wild places is that even if we never get there, our lives are better for it. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to sign up for podcasts of our show and register for our weekly newsletter. You can also find archive shows at our site. Our theme music was composed and performed by Memphis musicians Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage, with additional music by Christopher Reyes. Candace Ludlow edits Smart City. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.
National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and communities.